You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, I'm Zale Metnick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. Fraternities are a long-standing part of North American tradition. The first fraternity in the United States was established in the 1700s, and while much has changed since then in regards to what a fraternity is and how it operates, tradition and reverence for past customs is also an important cornerstone of frat culture. But as our culture, social norms, and perspectives regarding inclusivity continue to change rapidly, how have fraternities adjusted? What is the purpose of a fraternity? Why does someone decide to become a part of a fraternity? Are fraternities just for white privileged folk, or is that just an outdated misconception? While many cite their frat experiences as some of the most significant and monumental in their lives, others have certainly been traumatized by their pledging and hazing experiences. I'm joined today on the podcast by Dan Fail. Dan has been involved in the world of fraternities and sororities for over 20 years. He attended the University of North Carolina at Wilmington and was a founding father of Theta Chi Fraternity. After college, Dan traveled for Theta Chi Fraternity as a consultant. He later served as director of fraternity and sorority life at Elon University in North Carolina. He has been a full-time speaker with Campus Speak and has served as the director of consulting and coaching for Launchpoint Solutions. Dan, thank you for joining me.
Zale, thanks so much for having me, man. I'm excited to chat.
I wasn't in a fraternity. I was a nerd. I was sitting in the library all the time.
Hey, I would much rather have a fraternity of nerds that recruit from the chess club and just geek out on whatever Thursday night than opposed to like a group of just like, what are we going to do tonight, bro? So don't sell yourself short. I would say we've missed out. As fraternities, we missed out on having someone like you.
All right. Well, we're here now, so that's exciting.
Exactly. Let's just move onward and forward.
Exactly. So how did you get involved in the frat world?
I think, first of all, I'll put it out there in terms of like, I would consider myself a fraternity man, right? And so like I joined a fraternity, not a frat. And so putting those pieces out there, and it might sound semantic like, but it's just a very important piece for me.
What's the difference so people know between fraternity and frat when you use those words?
Right. So when you say frat, and when I say you, it's collective you, anyone. When anyone says the word frat, I think that there has been a very great, just a general misconception or preconception, as it were, of what that means. And so it feels very derogatory because people automatically think old school. People automatically think Animal House. People automatically think about frat as men at their worst. Plus, you know, frat might be a colloquial term used between fraternity brothers, but that doesn't necessarily mean that, like, I joined a fraternity, not a frat. It feels semantic-like.
Embedded in the word frat is a lot of those negative connotations.
100%, most certainly, yeah. So I was 17 years old going to college and, you know, I wanted to fit in. I wanted to meet people, girls, and I wanted to be social, alcohol. And so it seemed like the logical choice, right? They were the social outlet of a campus and I went to a campus that had fall recruitment. So you were able to join in your first semester in college. I ended up not joining the first one that I pledged that I was a part of. And we can get into that one a little bit later at some of our other topics. However, my roommate told me about this brand new organization that was starting, brand new, you know, men's fraternity on campus. And he's like, hey man, they've already, you know, are interested in me. And I was like, dude, you are awkward AF. Like, I don't know. Like, I am curious about this group if they have said that you could be a member. And so I went out for that, met some of the people. Turns out I went to high school with some of the guys. And it just felt like a group of people that you could just hang out and legitimately be your authentic self with. And I really enjoyed that. Whereas the first one I pledged, because I didn't go through with initiation, but everyone was a jock and everyone, it was certainly it was the group that all the women wanted to flock to because they were the like jockey, like we've got it all together. I'm from Cape Cod. But that wasn't how I felt, right? Like I'm not an athlete. I was an actor, right? Like And when I say actor, like I was in high school theater, right? I could act like I play sports. So I didn't feel like I fit in with that group. But yeah, joined this one. And it was an incredible experience. I became president at the end of my sophomore year. I served in various leadership roles through the organization. I loved my fraternity so much that I ended up traveling as a consultant for them. So I, you know, hopped in a car and spent a year of my life visiting other fraternity chapters of my own organization, helping them become better. Or as best as possible, and then ended up becoming a fraternity sorority advisor. So went to grad school, became an advisor, and continued along that route. I mean, I can honestly goodness say that my life has been forever impacted because of the choice I made to join my roommate's brand new fraternity that we got to kind of build from the ground up.
Your awkward AF roommate changed your life.
Yeah, absolutely loved. And, you know, and before he passed several years ago, it was a random passing. But before he passed, I wish that I had told him, like, hey, thanks for putting me on this journey together. And the fact that we got to go through so much was awesome. But I think those are the lifelong memberships that we talk about, or the lifelong friendships. And just it is not just a 4 years experience. It can be for life if you let it be for life. And now I get to travel around the country working with fraternities and sororities and communities to help them be better and recruit better men and women into our group. So that's just, it's the little things that I get to do now that I absolutely enjoy and love.
So Dan, what is the purpose of a fraternity exactly? For the people who just see a bunch of guys hanging out in a place together, because I'm very aware that that's not just what a fraternity is by any means. And I have friends who've described it as one of the most pivotal experiences in their lives in terms of leadership, teamwork, self-development, learning about themselves. So there's a lot that I don't think people, probably including myself, don't really understand about what a fraternity is.
Well, and I think to understand what we are is to acknowledge where we came from. Right. So, you know, in the late 1700s, when these organizations really kind of started to come into focus, but more or less founding, the first fraternity was founded in the late 1700s, really more of the, what we would consider the NIC or the traditional fraternity groups. Those came to existence because groups of students were at colleges, universities, places of higher education, and, you know, they're being taught Latin, they're being taught all these things, and the students were like, well, but what's going on in the world, and how does learning Latin help us right now? And the professors at the time would just be like, sit down, be quiet, have your chalkboard, you know, and learn, and that's what you're here to do. And so the students really formed as literary societies, as honor societies, to debate current events and how that related to the academic pursuits. Our original organizations all came together out of a sense of camaraderie and a desire to advance our own learning outside of the classroom. And some of them took on different shapes and sizes. My own organization was founded at a military institution by a 14 and 17 year old who wanted to stop hazing. They wanted to stop hazing at the military institution. So my organization took on a no hazing persona. And that was part of our own organization's journey. Now, does every single chapter within our group follow that? No, sadly. But I think, what is the purpose of fraternity? Fraternity and sorority exists to help men and women become the greatest version of themselves. And that is through some of the stuff that you listed. That's through peer-to-peer interactions, leadership development, engagement opportunities, fiscal independence and budgeting. And so that is what I see as a great opportunity. Now, where I see the biggest opportunity in terms of purpose is civic engagement, whether that's community service, philanthropic endeavors, but really it's the, when you look at the quote-unquote traditional fraternities and sororities, and when I say traditional fraternity and sorority, I mean the historically white fraternities and sororities, our biggest pitfall, or what we have not fully captured, is the social justice movement. How do we support those that don't look like us? Whereas when you look at historically Black fraternities and sororities, so that mostly they started HBCU, some of them started Indiana State. I mean, those really started from this sense of, let's all pull together. It was the early 1900s when a lot of those were started. Let's all pull together because we're not allowed into these other organizations. So we want to build the community. So when you look at NPHC, which is the National Panhellenic Council, when you look at those organizations, they are driven by lifelong membership. They are driven by civic engagement and social justice initiatives and providing educational programs for K through 12. Whereas really the quote unquote, again, traditional, historically white fraternities and sororities, while we still are members for the rest of our lives, we still just kind of focus on that 4 year engagement piece.
I think that's a purpose a lot of people would not know the way you just explained it. Mm-hmm. When you're an 18-year-old or a 17-year-old and you are deciding that you want to go into a fraternity, I imagine for some people those might be embedded in the reasons why you're doing so. But what is the what would the typical reason be that somebody decides, yeah, I want to get involved in this fraternity? Is it kind of that more stereotypical people wanting to be part of the cool group who is going to parties and with the label and prestige of being in a fraternity? Or is it just looking for camaraderie, an easy way to make friends when you're in an uncomfortable environment of university?
Yeah, all of the above. And everyone has their own individual desires. However, what's at the center of everything that you listed, and everything that a student wants to go to college with, is a need for connection. Human beings are pack beings, right? So we know that human connection can drive us to be better people. And we like to congregate, we like to group, you know? And so fraternities and sororities, when done right, can be the best place to grow and develop on a college campus. But I also fully recognize that a 17, 18, 19-year-old first-year student in college that's just kind of like, I don't know many, especially, I'll include myself in this, that come in and say, I want to live by ideals that are bigger than my own. And you don't think about a fraternity and sorority in that way. But you do think about it of, I don't want to feel alone. And so how can I not feel alone? What's available for me to join? And in some cases, what's the social outlet for this campus? Oh, it's controlled by one specific group of people. I hope I can go and get in to whatever social events that are happening. And part of that is, can I go and get in? I.e., do I need to join in order to be invited to those things? I think the sense of connection and the desire to not be alone are really where a lot of that does come from. And I think where we start to see it disperse in purpose is, how do we build said community? And is it just through social? Is it just through service? Is it just through engagement? Like, what does that look like?
I think that it's really important to explore that initial topic of camaraderie and that idea of finding connection, because that is such a reason why people go to university in general. Obviously, they're going for the education, but when people think about their university experience, most people have a pretty specific idea in mind of, I want camaraderie, I want to make new friends. And in a way, joining a fraternity is a proactive step in saying, I'm going to not leave it necessarily up to, it's not chance, but let's call it chance of who I meet in my residency. And I'm going to find a group of like-minded people and try to really immerse myself in a community. And I think there's a lot of positivity in that. Like you said, where that might diverge is how that's executed. Not in all cases, but in some cases, which we'll talk about.
In theory, this is absolutely incredible and should be one of the best experiences. In practice, that's where sometimes some people maybe don't live by everything that we say that we do.
Let's jump into some of the concerns that people have with fraternities and perhaps some of the misconceptions that people have. So when somebody's pledging, that experience is often associated with some negative connotations of the guys who are kind of vetting you as to whether you're going to be a part of the fraternity. They can be kind of tough on you. There's a lot of challenges. There's some embarrassment. There's hazing involved sometimes. And my impression is that the purpose of that is that by challenging you, that kind of makes you a stronger person. And by pushing you, that makes you better. I don't know if that's
great myths that people have convinced themselves of, right?
I needed to say the myths because I don't want to just jump into assuming that it's negative, but that's definitely what many people associate with as a pretty tough period pledging and all the hazing that goes along with that. What are your thoughts on the status of that and the truth of why that occurs?
All right, hazing is some bullshit. Here is the fact that most people who are hazers don't admit to, is that hazing is about power. That's it. It's the power that I have over you of your membership in something for the rest of your life. It's the power that, well, I did something, so you've got to do it and you got to do it worse. It is this snowball effect of garbage that has no place in our organization. And fun fact, hazing the way it exists now in terms of the paddling and the calisthenics and like all of that, hazing didn't exist in these organizations, any of our organizations truly like this until, honest to goodness, until after some of the GI Bill, right? So after the World Wars, when they were paying people to go to school and right, it's like join a fraternity of brotherhood and here's what we're going to do. We're going to go clean up the neighborhood and here's where, you know, like howdy doody style, we're going to go do this. And, you know, some of those veterans came in and like, no, this is how you build a brotherhood. And brought in some of those pieces of Army training, and not to just to dash on those who do service, because I think what's trained for the armed services, no matter the branch, is incredibly important for the safety of our country. So by no means am I trying to belittle that experience. However, fraternities and sororities should not have to have that same level of follow my instructions or be gone. Follow our, you know, follow our directions, or, you know, the sake of your existence and freedoms are going to be taken away. That's not where the fraternity and sorority movement is. None of our organizations were founded to beat the shit out of someone that's interested in our organization.
So the military folk were kind of following this mantra of hardship breeds personal growth and camaraderie, but that was really very much based on their experiences, and that was really a new phenomenon to fraternities.
Like, rather than making them prove their worth, I'm of the opinion that flip the coin, a pledge, a new member should never have to prove themselves of the organization. The organization should prove themselves worthy of the members, right? Rather than all this other stuff. And so I see some of the things that are like, there's hazing with a little H and hazing with a big H. Hazing a big H, making you drink till you pass out, beating the hell out of somebody with a paddle, forced calisthenics. All of that garbage we should have at some point, it shocks me that we don't, federal laws that legit prosecute and jail time, because that's endangerment. It's legitimately endangerment of human beings' lives. And I know some people who are other speakers in the field, and they've lost their children because of a hazing practice, because of quote unquote tradition. And I think it's absolute garbage that you should have to prove yourself. Some of the smaller things that I've seen are like, you know, in order to join our organization, you need to know all of our members. So here's a notebook and you need to interview every single brother or sister and get them to sign off that you've interviewed them. Well, I think that's garbage as well. And I say that because a new member, like if there are 10 new members and there are 50 members, that's 50 people I as one person have to interview. And what are you then going to make me do to get the signature, right? And that's where the little kind of like individual crap comes into play of, well, I won't do it unless you go buy me lunch. That's not needed. That's, again, a power play to feel like I have a stake over your future.
That's an important distinction, though, the capital H hazing versus the lowercase H hazing, that stuff you just spoke about. That's bad, but that's just kind of reflective of a crappy personality, somebody who needs their ego to be boosted, whereas the first is...
Yes, but it's still spelled the same way, right? I mean, it's still not okay. I think that there are ways that you can bring men and women together to serve common purpose and to see their value and to challenge them to communicate and to bond in a better way. I just don't think it needs to be done in an interview. Or if it is the interview, to use that example, then why can't I, the member, interview one of the 10 new members so that I can get to know you a little bit more, right? If you are the future, what are your interests in this organization? Do you ever want to run for a position? Oh my gosh, I had that position last year, right? Like those are the types of things as opposed to a scavenger hunt where it's like, hey, go do a panty raid or like whatever. I don't know that still happens. Hopefully not. But like, what are those things where it's like, rather than go steal a pride flag, why don't you say like, go find where our organization first met on campus? Go meet with our faculty advisor or staff advisor, all right? Like, can you not make it developmental so that they understand the resources that exist on campus? And yeah, it sounds stupid, it's cheesy. Well, guess what? You don't have to do all the other crap because that's stupid too. And what no one has really truly studied, there's a couple books out there, but no one's truly like done a deep dive into the long-term effects of the negative hazing that has occurred over the last, you know, 50 years.
And there must be pretty significant consequences for people that if it hasn't been studied, it hasn't been studied. But I'm sure you've heard of a lot of personal anecdotes of people who were fairly traumatized by perhaps the smaller
Or the larger. And there's some people who take pride in it. Like, hey, here's the scars that I have from that one night or that one ritual that's not a ritual. It was garbage. Like, it was just something that someone thought it would be funny to do. And it's where I will say is it's scary to see how quick it can happen, right? And I'll use my own experience as an example. Again, I'm a founding father of my chapter, meaning I was one of the first people to start my chapter on a campus. We thought that it would be funny, just funny, to give the new members that came in after us nicknames, what we thought was a harmless nickname. Now, looking back, that was not a good nickname to give someone, right? Because it could have messed with them, or it gave them a false sense of worth or lack of worth. And then it was like, within a year, it was kind of like, oh, well, you know, like now that you've got nicknames, well, there's a lack of respect. So like, clean the garage. And that's really the limit of, that my organization got to. But looking back, it was stupid. Like, why give a nickname when you could just call them their name? Why make them clean if it was a respect thing? That's because we weren't giving the respect to them, the member, new member, right? And so again, that's that weird cycle that comes into play of, yeah, big H, small H, none of it belongs because none of us were founded on that ideal. And when you look at every single fraternity and sorority, whether that's a membership at the NIC, Panhellenic, NPHC, NAPA, NALFO, name the governing body or even just local group, everyone has a no hazing clause of some sort. Every single organization says we do not stand for hazing. And yet it's one of the hardest things to get rid of in our organizations.
Are there still cases that have been reported in the recent past of deaths or really bad consequences like you were speaking about before that have happened from hazing and fraternity experiences?
Yeah. I mean, we are one of the few industries, fraternity and sorority, we are one of the few industries in the world, and this is a sad statement, that kills our members year in and year out from hazing practices. Or, you know, if it's not an alcohol hazing related death, then it's something around, you know, calisthenics or physical performance, or it's something that ends up, you know, being around, you know, fell off a porch or, you know, like something like that happens. But we're one of the few industries that continues to do that. We're also one of the hardest to insure industries. Like, we are considered in one of the top 10 riskiest industries to insure, next to like handling hazardous waste materials. It's like, who would you like to insure? This hazardous waste company that's like killing things, or fraternities and sororities, which should be doing stuff, but also killing things, right? And that's in and of itself a statement that I'm hopeful that we continue to grow and get rid of, you know, get rid of a lot of the bad apples.
It's strange because the fraternity and the sorority, they're microcosms of society on some level. Yet because they're under the label of fraternity and sorority, there's on some level a free pass on the things that are considered acceptable. Like you said before, people should be legislated against for doing some of the things that they do in fraternities. And if you took some of these people out of the context of a fraternity or sorority, these are probably good people who wouldn't do these things otherwise. But because it's so baked into the supposed tradition, which you've debunked a little bit, some of these things that people otherwise wouldn't do or wouldn't be tolerated suddenly become status quo. I want to talk a bit about the partying scene in fraternities, because that I think is something that definitely attracts people to coming to fraternities. And there's nothing wrong with partying. And I mean, there's different degrees of what you consider partying, but that happens at university, it happens at college, it happens in life. And drinking is a part of that. But there's certainly an association with fraternities and frat parties that they can get out of hand. They can be quite wild with the partying. And what degree of that is reality and what degree of that is public misperception?
I think that the reality has shaped the perception more so than the perception shaping reality, right? So if we're going to go context, again, our organizations were honor societies to start with. Parties weren't really a thing in the 18, 1900s, or they were, but they weren't to this extent. Binge drinking wasn't seen as such an extent. I do think there is a party issue. You know, when people talk about the organizations, usually it's the, well, are you a part of a social fraternity, an honor fraternity, or a service fraternity? And so I think some of those that belong to the traditional, historically white fraternities and sororities, I think that we've just been like, oh, we're social groups? Yeah, let's be social. And I think that they've just owned that. Social is a part of the fraternal experience. a lot of our organizations, I mean, chapters tend to use that as a crutch to then meet other people. The irony about fraternity and sorority is that we've given control over centuries old organizations. We, in essence, given control to 17 to 22 year olds and then are like, make good choices and hope that everyone makes good choices. So yeah, I think the party aspect is a part of it. Where you see the difference is who's able to not just make it their sole identity. And those are the groups that tend to do better, both, you know, on a campus or in the region or in the nation for awards and for engagement and for member experiences. Because we also know that those who only focus on social tend to not have good accountability. Do you know that the higher the social, the lower the overall member engagement, or especially after graduation? And that's just some of the data that's been recent.
One of the issues with the parties isn't necessarily, there's nothing inherently wrong about partying or depending on your views about drinking. It's what happens at those parties. What happens if you drink in excess? And that's where the trouble happens, when violence can happen, where hazing can happen, where sexual abuse can happen. How do you practically have an environment where you've got 17 to 22 year olds who want to have a party, but how do you avoid the excess that can then lead to these situations, especially in that issue of sexual assault? Because that's a very real thing that does happen. And it's getting even trickier these days as the conversation about consent changes. And can you even have proper consent when two people are inebriated? Yet, of course, there's going to be sexual things that happen at these parties. So it's just really fuzzy. When you're having these parties, how do you have them in a responsible way?
First off, it's my hope and mission and desire that the collegiate fraternity and sorority house should be the safest place on a college campus. It should be the safest place on a college campus. Sadly, it is not. What we see is that the women's organizations that have houses, those tend to be pristine. Why? Because they don't allow men or parties in their houses. And then the men's groups that have houses, your feet tend to stick to the floor because they're just not regulated the same way. Also, because the women have made such great, you know, rules and regulations to say, this is what you cannot do. Men's groups haven't, per se, followed the same path. And so the men are like, well, we need to meet girls, so we're going to invite them to our house. And what brings them over? Maybe a theme, maybe alcohol. And so our movement, our entire fraternity and sorority movement started to focus more on alcohol in the 70s, 80s as a recruiting tool. So that's kind of how it became such a crutch for us. You know, in the 60s and with Vietnam, it was very much the like anti-establishment, anti-organization based. And so we were like, oh God, our membership numbers are down. We need to be social and recruit. In the midst of all that, some of our policies, while they have shifted and they became safer focused, we didn't provide the infrastructure to the organizations to be more successful, right? So here you have a fraternity that's doing some social things, but their house has fallen apart, or it's not well lit or ventilated or whatever. And so there's slips and falls and things that can happen. But when it comes to like a safety piece, usually the reason that we don't hear about things, I say we collectively as a university administrator, knowing that I'm not a university administrator anymore, but we often see that we'll hear about it because there's a police report, or we'll hear about it because, you know, we get a report on it at some point. I worked at one campus and I loved this approach. Initially, they took an individual amnesty clause. And so they put it into the student conduct code that it was an amnesty piece, that if you had been drinking too much, underage or not, and you called an ambulance or you called the EMTs on campus or campus police to say, hey, my friend needs help, while both of you would go to the student conduct to have those developmental conversations, your outcomes, your sanctions would not be that bad. And when I say that bad, I mean like, hey, we're having this conversation. Thank you for doing the right thing. What led you to that point? Is there anything else that you need help with? Right. And so really it wasn't seen as a punitive piece. I then was able to work with conduct to say, how can we make that for an organization? Can there be an organization amnesty piece? And I know that had been in the works of, well, what does this look like? So if I got too drunk at an organization event, but I, as the organization event, you know, like coordinator or the social chair or whatever, I'm like, oh God, like some of these people are way too drunk, or this party got way out of hand, or whatever that is. They stop and they don't call for help because they don't want the organization to get in trouble. So by addressing, hey, your organization will still come through conduct and we'll talk about ways to make your events safer, we're not going to suspend you, right? We're not going to completely get you off campus for 5 years. That will not be an outcome.
So people are comfortable saying, yeah, it's getting out of hand. We can try to step in ourselves before it gets more out of hand. And we don't need to fear the consequences to the same degree as we otherwise would have, which would have deterred us from stepping in.
100%. And so we say that we are self-governed organizations, and nothing says self-governance like, hey, I will not only govern myself when things are good, but if shit's hitting the fan, right, then I also can govern to do the right thing. And that's what we know. And as a speaker who goes across the nation talking about the intersection of alcohol and consent, and like, how do you plan a party? Well, by not having a safety precaution plan and planning to like not get in trouble, that's not a plan. That's a hope and a prayer. And so you can't go into it planning to just be lucky about not getting in trouble. You know, there's a lot of offices and a lot of people who are fraternity sorority advisors that meet with their students that are planning events that are known about, usually it's the registered events, but like, hey, walk me through your safety plan. What is it going to look like? Are you going to wristband? Are you checking IDs? Like, are you checking them, or is the third party, the venue going to check them? There's all these different layers in place, but sometimes our students just don't want to do it. Why? Because it's easier to throw a random ass house party where everyone just brings beer or we provide and hope to not get in trouble, as opposed to doing everything right, renting buses, renting out the venue, because that's money. And while I understand that, I think the institutions and the organizations, both the national governing groups and everybody, need to figure out a way forward of how do we build the trust for the students to know that we're not going to shut them down by calling the cops on themselves. Like, how do you reward? Like, yes, you broke the laws and many rules and policies, but you did the right thing in the end. And not to celebrate that, but to also not squash the opportunity for that to occur.
That's a really practical perspective.
Yeah. That's what I like to live in hope. But to also answer your question about, you know, organizations or the environments for, you know, when drinking does happen, more negative things could happen, right? That's the first domino effect. And how do you talk to students about being safe around sex when drinking is involved? Number one, every state is different. Number two, every institution within the state is different, right? I live in California. In California, we have an affirmative ongoing consent law. Now, you want to talk about a scary thing to try to figure out how to quote unquote prove, or not even quote unquote, how to actually prove should something happen. That's a lot of gray area. I'm a 6'2", 225 pound guy. One beer is going to affect me differently than someone else. So can I consent after one beer? I think so. But some institutions say that first sip of alcohol, you can't. You're no longer allowed to. So how do you, again, I think, give them the better skills? I think students know when stuff is going down that shouldn't go down. I think where we've stopped them is the ability to report, or we're not giving them permission to, you know, be a bad guy, like break up something that should not happen. Like, if you think your two friends are going to regret that in the morning, insert yourself now. Like stop it before it starts. I worked with one organization, a sorority, that they were jokingly referred to as the gum chapter, G-U-M, like bubblegum chapter. Because what they would do is, rather than like shoulder tapping and being like, what would our founder say with your behavior? Which is just, again, garbage, especially if someone's been drinking. I don't care what they say. It's like, hey, do you have any gum? And it's like, well, you know, no, I don't have any gum. And so if someone's acting a fool, making out with someone on the dance floor, dancing on a table, it's like, hey, well, if you want to make out with your man that you're trying to hit on, you might want some fresh breath. So let's go get some gum. And that was a way to diffuse the situation without anyone feeling like a bad person. But then also not approaching it from this holier than thou. Well, I've never made a mistake when drinking, which is BS. Like, if I think we've all made mistakes in our lives, drinking or not. And so to say that I'm perfect, you automatically turn off all your members that you're trying to get to respond to do the right thing.
This episode of the Preconceived Podcast is brought to you by Speaker Labs. Speaker Labs helps people become rockstar public speakers. Most people think public speaking is a unique skill that only a select few possess. At Speaker Labs, they disagree. To them, public speaking isn't a unique skill set. It's a unique context for a skill that all humans already possess, communication. If you can communicate, you can public speak. All you need to do is change the way you think. Speaker Labs will show you how. Visit courses.speakerlabs.ca and use the code PRECONCEIVED at checkout for 50% off of your lifetime access to Speaker Lab's brand new online course, The Lab. I've checked The Lab out, and I can tell you firsthand it is awesome, and it's helped me not only with presentations and public speaking in general, but even with this podcast. So I highly recommend you check this out and use the code PRECONCEIVED for 50% off. On that notion of privilege and inclusivity, do frats inherently widen the gap between the privileged and underprivileged because of the payment that's required to join a fraternity or a sorority? Or are there other mechanisms in place to help people out, sponsorships or scholarships for people who are interested in joining but can't afford it?
Yeah. Zale, my heart wants to say that there is not a gap, but my brain and experience know otherwise. My eyes have seen otherwise. Yeah, there is. I mean, there is a gap between privileged and what we would consider, I guess, non-privileged or unprivileged populations, I think. But that is inherent in society. And I think fraternities and sororities are a microcosm of the larger systemic issues in America. Are all fraternities and sororities racist? No. Are all fraternities and sororities anti-racist? So let me rephrase. Are all historically white fraternities and sororities racist? No. Are all historically white fraternities and sororities anti-racist? Also no. So like when George Floyd happened and when all the movements that happened in the United States and even the world were going on, there were organizations that didn't make a Black Lives Matter statement. Or if they did, it was very like almost like corporate based service, right? Just lip service. So when we talk about privilege, there is privilege that exists in fraternities and sororities. And you know what? I think that there should be. I'm paying for an experience. Do I think the fraternity and sorority experience should be free? No. Do I think that we need to eliminate the barriers of trying out to see if you like the fraternity and sorority experience, meaning the fees to register for Russia recruitment, the fees that are required for intake for the NPHC and MGC groups that are out there, right? Like, I think those fees are sometimes a deterrent. And so we are missing so many capable, amazing people because they don't want to pay for the upfront fees of maybe even getting in or not. Or B, they just don't want to pay for their friends. Now, my favorite like rationale about like paying for my friends, I paid $300 a semester for 4 years. So like do the math, blah, blah, blah. I see it as an investment in myself, right? So while I paid $300 for 4 years or a semester for 4 years, I'm still getting return on that investment, right? So I'm still feeling value from that experience. So, you know, I would say that I leased my friends for 4 years and I got a great experience for the rest of my life. So what does that look like and what does that mean? And if we can eliminate some of the registration costs, I think that might help those that are like a first gen. But let's also look at the recruitment practice. We're not going after first gen students. We're not looking at sophomores, juniors, seniors, transfers, international students. We're not looking outside of the box of who's registering for recruitment. Fraternities and sororities, again, predominantly white, historically white fraternities and sororities, tend to just look at who signed up for Rush for recruitment, and that's who we go after, as opposed to who's the leader on campus, right? Who's involved in student government that we should be able to tap into as a possible member? Who's, you know, a president of this organization that does great service, and why aren't they members of our organizations? That's where we need to do a better job of bridging some of that privilege gap. Where I would love to see this occur is those predominantly white or historically white fraternities and sororities use our power and privilege to lift up and allow voices of underrepresented, underprivileged to then exist.
The more we have this conversation, the more I think of this idea that it's a microcosm of society. And the problem is it's a microcosm of society and society is flawed. So when you're putting 17 to 22-year-olds together and you're telling them, manage, lead, and run your own society. Is it even possible to have the ideal? Society is not ideal, of course, but it's a really tough thing to accomplish. The ideals behind what a fraternity and a sorority should be and potentially could be are fantastic, I think. And it sounds like there are some fraternities and sororities that do a really, really great job at that. But how feasible is getting closer to this ideal of what it means to be in this great organization? Or are we just limited by the fact that we're dealing with 17 to 22 year olds who, even when they're older, are going to be flawed and make bad decisions?
Yeah. Damn it. That's a good question. I think it's okay to strive for the ideal.
Yeah.
I think it's okay to make mistakes along the way. I think it's okay to fumble. I think it's okay to stumble. I think it's okay to not hit your mark. Where I think it's not okay is it's not okay to just sit and be complacent. I think it's not okay to look at what we've always done and do it for that reason. I think tradition is bullshit in some ways, right? Like tradition for my fraternity are our colors, red and white, right? Tradition for my organization is you celebrate the founding of our organization on Founders Day. Like that's a tradition. But some of these other local customs are detracting from our larger mission. Do I think a 17 to 22 year old will fully embrace the mission and ideals of our organizations? No. Do I think we can show them the possibilities? Yes. But what we need is more of a collective movement forward, or partnerships and coalitions to help make this happen. I think we're starting to see some progress made. The fact that some, you know, there are some historically white fraternities that in the last several years have started to adapt and say, if you identify as male, you're allowed membership. That's something that you don't see happen that often, that a predominantly historically white organization is like, if you identify as male, so if you're a trans male, like, yes, we'll consider you as membership, because the value of you as an individual coming to our organization is what we see, not, you know, we're gonna check where you go when you pee, right? Like that's not a thing. And so understanding sex versus gender, we're starting to make progress there. I still think we have a ways to go to collectively acknowledge our own racist past. The fact that America can't even like get all the states to say, yes, we had slaves that were stolen from Africa. Like we can't even get every state to acknowledge that. I don't think that we'll get all the fraternities to acknowledge our collective racist past.
And I think what you opened up with in that answer rings really true of we can always strive for the ideal. And that is ultimately important in every aspect of society. It seems like a lot of this can come down to leadership, whether it's the advisors or whether it's the leaders of the fraternity or the sorority needing to establish that right culture. Because despite all the learning and education and progressiveness in society, it's still thought of, it's cool to do certain things when you're younger. Even when you're older, it's cool to drink excessively. It's cool to do drugs. It's cool to black out. It's cool to get girls regardless how you get them. And those are just values that stem from the top. And if you don't have the right leadership in a fraternity or sorority and the right advisors, I could see that really being what tips a frat.
Yes, it's a leader's piece. I think we're not giving enough role models, positive role models, or the role models that we do have been put on this like pedestal that's impossible to achieve, whereas we're all humans. And so that, I think it comes back to the vulnerability and the safety that we all have with each other. So can you create effective change?
Dan, do you have any final thoughts you want people listening to this to come away with regarding fraternities and sororities?
You don't have to join one in order to fit in on campus. There are so many, there's hundreds of campus organizations that you could find and do your own. So fraternity and sorority, if you're not a member, it doesn't mean it's the end all be all. I also want to say that if you're interested in a fraternity or sorority, explore all the options that exist on a campus, whether that's the social, whether that's the historically black, whether that's the historically Asian, whether that's honors or service, right? Like explore all the options that exist on your campus. If you're a parent listening to this and you're like, hell no, will my child join? You would join both of my parents in that thought process. My mom, I love her. still can't pronounce or spell what organization I'm in. And that's fine. But I also know that my mom is now one of those advocates that's like, yes, I still don't understand it, but seeing how Dan has grown over the years and what he's become, if he attributes that to fraternity, then great, that's what it was too. And then I will leave it with, I'm a firm believer that fraternity and sorority, when done right, when we live our espoused values and when we do what we say we will do, has the biggest opportunity and possibility to shift this entire movement in the right direction. We literally can solve so many campus or community issues if we do what we say we will do. And are we perfect? No. But you should want to strive to be better tomorrow than you were today. And the effective organizations that do that are the ones that will continue to grow and thrive, in my opinion.
And it seems like you have done a tremendous job in trying to foster that kind of culture. And congratulations on all the work you've done.
Thank you. I would say that it brings a lot of joy. It brings a lot of hair pulling, but it is one of the most rewarding pieces. And I'm very privileged and honored the fact that you asked me to be a part of this, by the way. And then, but also the fact that, you know, it's wild that I get paid to help fraternities and sororities realize their potential, whether that's through conversation, healthy masculinity, recruitment, you know, consent, all the different facets that exist in the world. But being able to engage as a consultant and as a speaker on those items is an absolute pleasure.
Dan, where can people learn more about you or any of the work that you're doing?
Sure. So the easiest place to find me is at www.danfail.com. So again, you spell my name D-A-N-F as in Frank, A-I-L-L. So fail like to flunk, but with another L on the end. And Dan Fail is also basically all the social media handles, whether that's LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, it's all there. So feel free to reach out through the website or through any of the other social handles.
Well, Dan, thanks again. Really appreciate you joining me. And thank you everybody for listening to another episode of Preconceived. Have a great day.